What if I told you that the only reason you can see the color red, like the only reason you can tell a ripe apple from a green leaf, is basically because of a massive, sloppy biological mistake millions of years ago?
Yeah, an absolute blunder, which is totally counterintuitive, right?
Frankly.
Especially with, everything we're taught about how progress actually happens. We're conditioned to believe that life and, I mean, society by extension too, only moves forward through ruthless optimization.
Right, we definitely have this default lens. We look at a highly successful company or, I don't know, a champion athlete or a thriving ecosystem, and we just assume we're looking at a lean, mean, efficient machine.
Yeah, exactly.
Like every ounce of fat has been trimmed. We think progress is binary. You know,
Yeah.
you optimize or you die.
Which is comforting in a weird way. It gives us a very clean rule book.
Right.
We really like the idea that struggle and competition and, the elimination of the weak naturally leave us with the best possible version of reality.
But then you step into the world of actual biological innovation. You look at how our eyes evolved or how our brains developed, and suddenly that whole rule book is just thrown out the window.
Dodo at the
You
window.
realize you're looking at a reality fundamentally driven not by perfect efficiency, but by excess.
Yeah, excess and redundancy.
Right, by things that at first glance look entirely like waste.
And that's the wild part. The things we've been told for decades are massive liabilities. Overlap, messiness, inefficiency, they actually turn out to be the secret engines of the universe.
And that is exactly what we're getting into today. So welcome to the deep dive. You, the listener, are the third person in our conversation today, and we are just thrilled to have you here.
Absolutely.
Because today's mission is a big one. We are going to completely rewire how you think about evolution, how you think about progress, and honestly, how human society is built from the ground up.
It's a huge topic.
It is. And we are pulling from this incredibly fascinating, though very dense, 2026 academic white paper by Dr. Bechara Sahili. It's titled The Evolution of Worlds.
And what's amazing about this paper is that the author is synthesizing fields that, frankly, rarely speak to one another.
Oh, yeah.
We're pulling threads from molecular biology, cognitive science, sociology, institutional design, all of it, just to deconstruct that popular survival of the fittest narrative.
Okay, let's unpack this because to really grasp this, we first have to do some serious unlearning.
Yeah, we have to deconstruct the invisible water we're all swimming in.
The author calls this the selectionist civilizational grammar.
Right, and the word grammar is doing a lot of heavy lifting there.
How so?
Well, a grammar basically dictates how you structure your thoughts, right? It's the invisible rule book for how you construct reality.
Got it.
So modern society has taken Charles Darwin's theory of natural selection, which, to be clear, is scientifically valid and completely foundational for biology.
Right, the science is real.
Exactly. But we've taken it and blown it up into this total all-encompassing worldview.
Darwin observed how heritable variations in differential reproduction lead to adaptation. Like the finch with the slightly better beak survives the drought, the biological mechanism. But we took that mechanism and basically turned it into an ideology.
We abstracted it entirely. And this narrative makes scarcity the very first fundamental truth of existence. Just think about how we're taught economics or even sociology.
Right. The baseline assumption is always that there are not enough resources.
Always. And if scarcity is the baseline, well, then competition is the natural state of affairs.
And if competition is the natural state, then optimization and pruning the weak aren't just unavoidable.
They're the only acceptable engines of improvement.
Which means we are explicitly taught that progress only comes from the elimination of the unfit. I mean, if you're listening to this on your commute, just think about your workplace.
Oh, absolutely.
Think about performance reviews or college admissions. We rank, we sort, and we prune.
And once that becomes your civilizational grammar, it just migrates into every single human system we build.
Yeah.
We start treating economic markets as pure selection machines.
Yes.
We assume that if a corporation survives and, accumulates capital, it must be because it's socially useful and inherently fit.
Right. Or we look at a social program and argue that if it can't prove immediate, measurable quarterly returns, it's unfit and must be cut.
Exactly. It creates this deep paranoia about redundancy. Anything that isn't actively producing immediate value gets labeled as waste.
So spare capacity, idle time, diverse ecosystems, overlapping institutions,
Right.
they all just look like inefficiencies waiting to be optimized away.
We strip away the margin, we make the system lean, centralized, and entirely dependent on uninterrupted flows.
And the problem, which the paper points out with just devastating clarity, is that a system optimized purely for normal expected conditions becomes incredibly brittle the exact moment a disturbance exceeds that narrow range of expectations.
Which is inevitable.
Right. Let's talk about a painfully illustrative example of this from the text, which is the COVID-19 pandemic.
Yeah, that's a perfect example.
Think about health systems globally in 2018. For decades, hospital administrators, driven by this exact hyper-efficient grammar we're talking about, had been actively eliminating reserve capacities.
Because spare beds, excess medical supplies, overlapping staff rotations, they viewed all of it as financial waste.
Right. They were optimizing for average demand.
Exactly. An empty hospital bed was seen as a loss of revenue rather than, you know, a vital buffer against the unknown.
Lean hospitals.
Lean hospitals. But then the pandemic hits, the demand surges, and those heavily optimized, hyper-efficient health systems just completely fractured.
Why? Because they optimized away their ability to survive a shock.
Yeah.
They had absolutely no generative margin.
And it reveals this profound inversion in our societal logic. The institutions we originally created to serve living purposes, like healing people in a hospital, they end up being assessed solely by their own internal metrics of procedural throughput.
Wait, say that again?
So, system survival replaces life service as the hidden criterion. A hospital can be deemed financially fit and highly successful on a balance sheet, even while patients are literally lined up in the hallways, unable to obtain timely care.
Man, that is bleak. But I want to push back on the biological side of this selectionist myth for a second.
Sure.
Let's look at the actual science of evolution.
Mm-hmm.
If selection is just about pruning the tree, cutting away the dead wood, eliminating the unfit, where do the branches come from in the first place?
That is the pivotal question, and it's the one that selectionism completely fails to answer.
Because to me, praising natural selection for the brilliant complexity of life is kind of like praising an editor for cutting a manuscript down to a tight 300 pages, but completely ignoring the author who actually generated the messy, brilliant first draft.
I love that analogy. It's so accurate.
Like, an editor can fix a typo. An editor can cut a boring chapter. But an editor cannot write a new story from scratch.
Right.
Selection is subtractive. It doesn't create. It only preserves or destroys what is already there.
Yes. Natural selection is incredibly effective at explaining differential retention. It explains who survives and who disappears. It explains how a trait is refined over time.
But it can't explain the draft.
Exactly. Selection, by itself, cannot fully explain the structured generation of possibilities. It cannot explain how the variants got there to be selected in the first place.
So where does the draft come from?
Well, strictly random variation isn't a sufficient answer either, which is what we used to believe.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Biological variation isn't just a completely uniform random sampling of every conceivable state. A mutation happens within a lineage that already has a specific architecture, specific constraints, a specific history.
Okay, so the field of possible change is biased by what already exists.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The generation of novelty is a distinct process from the retention of novelty.
This leaves us with a massive critical question for human society. If we structure our entire civilization around the selectionist grammar, if we constantly punish error, strip away redundancy, and ruthlessly prune our systems in the name of efficiency, how can we ever generate new solutions?
We can't.
Right. If people and communities can't survive experimentation, the space of possible reform shrinks to nothing.
And if every error is treated as proof of unfitness, learning turns into concealment. People just hide their mistakes.
Yeah.
So since selection alone can't explain innovation, we really have to look at what actually drives change from within the organism itself.
Okay, so if we aren't being pulled forward by the invisible hand of natural selection towards some perfect ideal, how do we actually evolve? The author introduces a concept here. Autopoiesis.
Yes.
Let's break that down because this sounds incredibly abstract.
It does. The term was coined by Chilean biologists Humberto Maturana and Francisco Varela. Auto meaning self, and poiesis meaning creation or production.
So self-creation.
Right. It's the idea that living things are fundamentally defined by their continuous self-creation. But to understand this, you have to grasp the crucial distinction they make between organization and structure.
Okay, I always struggle with those two words because in corporate speak, they mean basically the exact same thing.
They really do. But in biology, they are profoundly different. Organization refers to the core relations that must be conserved for a unity to remain the kind of unity it is.
Wait, break that down for me.
It is the network of processes that makes you.
Okay.
Structure, on the other hand, refers to the actual physical components that realize that organization at any particular fleeting moment in time.
You know, the easiest way to ground this for the listener is to think about your own body as you sit there listening to this. Your cells are constantly dying, millions of them.
Yeah, all the time.
And they are constantly being replaced. Over the course of a few years, almost every single physical molecule in your body, your skin, your organs, your bones, is swapped out.
It's the ship of Theseus paradox playing out in your flesh.
Exactly. Your physical structure changes completely. But your organization, that fundamental you-ness, the network of relations that makes you a living human being, is conserved.
And understanding this corrects a massive error in how we view the world. We tend to view organisms as machines.
Like a car on an assembly line.
Right. We think of bodies as things assembled from externally specified parts. But a living system isn't a car. It continuously produces and distinguishes itself through its own internal operations.
Identity isn't a static substance.
No. Identity is the continuity of organization through structural change.
So health isn't about freezing your body in time and stopping change. Health is the ability to keep functioning, to keep regenerating through the inevitable changes.
What's fascinating here is how this concept scales up beautifully to what Maturana and Jorge Mapodozis call natural drift.
Natural drift. Okay, what is that?
We usually think of evolution as an organism adapting to fit an external environment, like a key fitting into a pre-existing lock.
Yeah.
Natural drift says no. Evolution doesn't have a destination. The environment doesn't hand an organism a blueprint and say, become this.
So the environment isn't an instructive agent. It doesn't tell the organism what to do.
Exactly. Organisms undergo structural variations based on their own internal makeup, their structural determinism.
Okay.
And as long as they maintain their autopoiesis, as long as they stay alive and conserve their core organization, the lineage just drifts through time.
There is no ladder of progress.
Nope. There is no optimizing engineer trying to reach a final perfect design.
It's just wandering, but it's wandering viably. Like, as long as you don't die, you keep drifting, exploring new structural configurations.
Yes. And this introduces the concept of structural coupling, because the organism isn't drifting in a void, right? It is constantly interacting with its medium, its environment.
Sure.
But the organism and the environment don't confront each other as totally independent, completed realities. They actually co-create each other through recurrent interaction.
The paper uses the classic example of a beaver building a dam here.
Oh, that's a great one.
The beaver doesn't just passively arrive in an environment and adapt to it. The beaver acts. It chops down trees. It blocks the river. It builds a dam.
Yeah.
It fundamentally alters the environment. But in doing so, it creates a new environment, a pond, which then dictates the conditions for the beaver's future survival and the survival of its offspring.
They bring forth a world together. The organism and the environment are structurally coupled.
And humans do this on a massive scale.
Oh, a huge scale. We construct languages, cities, laws, economies. We transform our medium, and that transformed medium then transforms us. We are in a constant reciprocal dance of structural coupling.
Okay, so how does this redefine our civilizational grammar? Like, how does this help us out of that optimization trap?
Well, it frees us from the paralyzing idea of a predetermined optimum. Society doesn't need to have a perfect utopian blueprint finalized before it tries to improve. It doesn't need to know the final destination. It just needs to conserve the conditions that keep life-serving possibilities open. We just need to maintain our vital life functions while allowing our structures to safely drift and iterate.
But wait, if organisms are constantly drifting and changing their structure, why doesn't an organism just immediately die when it makes a wrong move? Because there have to be a safety net, right? Random structural changes can be incredibly dangerous. If you tweak the wrong gear in a Swiss watch, the watch stops.
It does.
So how does biological life try out all these new structures without immediately collapsing?
This is the core of the mystery. How does innovation actually happen without killing the host? And that brings us to generative reserve and inverse Darwinism.
Inverse Darwinism. I love this concept. This comes from researchers Matt Kalkman and Terrence Deacon. And it is the direct antidote to the scarcity mindset we talked about earlier.
It really is. Traditional Darwinism starts with Malthusian scarcity. There are not enough resources, so everyone competes and the weak are eliminated.
Right.
Inverse Darwinism flips that entirely. It starts with excess. It argues that true evolutionary novelty doesn't come from desperate scarcity. It comes from duplication, redundancy, and excess capacity.
Let's walk through the mechanism of this because it's fascinating.
Sure.
Let's imagine a single gene that performs a vital function for an organism, say, digesting a specific protein.
Okay.
If that gene mutates, the organism might die because it loses that vital function. The system is incredibly brittle.
Very brittle.
But what happens if, by some biological accident, that gene is duplicated?
Well, now you have a spare part. You have redundancy.
Yes.
One copy of the gene can keep doing the vital life-saving job. It conserves the organization. But the duplicate gene is now free. It is no longer strictly bound by the need to keep the organism alive.
It's buffered by the redundancy.
Exactly.
So it basically has evolutionary permission to wander. It can
yeah.
mutate. It can undergo natural drift.
What would have been a fatal error in a lean single copy system is completely neutralized because of the excess capacity.
Mm-hmm.
The duplicate gene can drift. It can lose its original function entirely. It can start doing something slightly different. And over time, this waste component, this redundant part, might actually stumble into a complementary relationship with the original part or with something else entirely.
It discovers a division of labor. It creates an entirely new capacity. And this brings us back to the hook I mentioned at the very beginning of our conversation.
Oh, trichromatic vision.
Trichromatic vision. The reason we can see color.
It's the perfect illustration of inverse Darwinism in action.
Walk us through it.
So early on, our mammalian ancestors had what's called dichromatic vision. They had two types of color receptors, opsin genes.
Okay.
But then an incredibly lucky error occurred. One of those opsin genes duplicated. Now, if the organism only had two genes, a mutation would probably ruin its sight.
Right, the watch would stop.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But because there was a duplicate, a spare, the original gene kept functioning.
Yeah.
The animal could still see as well as before.
But the duplicate gene?
The duplicate began to drift. It mutated. And eventually, its sensitivity to light wavelengths shifted just slightly.
And it didn't just add a third isolated color, right? The organism's brain was eventually able to compare the overlapping signals from the original gene and the mutated duplicate.
Yes, that comparison generated a richer, multidimensional spectrum of color. It allowed us to see reds and greens and distinguish ripe fruit from leaves.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because the new capacity didn't come from desperate competition. It came from having a spare part that was allowed to mess up.
Researchers Kalkman and Deakin actually connect this biological process to a concept in logic and philosophy called abductive inference. This was developed by the philosopher Charles Sanders Peirce.
Let's translate that for the listener because abductive inference sounds pretty heavy.
It does.
Like, deduction is taking a premise to a logical conclusion. Induction is finding a pattern from many examples. So what is abduction?
Abduction is basically the generation of a plausible hypothesis through resemblance, or what Peirce called iconism.
Resemblance.
Yeah, you make a leap based on a likeness. In biology, when a gene duplicates, it begins as a functional likeness of something that already works. It's an icon of a successful strategy.
So it's not just a completely random string of genetic code. It's a proven winner, just copied.
Exactly. When it starts to drift and mutate, its variations aren't completely random, nor are they directed by conscious foresight. They are historically biased.
They are generated from a viable theme.
Kalkman and Deakin call this prepared possibility. As Louis Pasteur said, chance favors the prepared mind.
Right.
In evolution, chance favors the prepared system, the system that has preserved enough of what works to allow part of itself to safely wander.
If you were listening to this at work, think about your corporate structure. We hire management consultants to come in and identify overlapping roles, redundant departments, excess inventory.
And we fire people and cut budgets to eliminate it.
Exactly. We think we are making the organism stronger. But according to inverse Darwinism, redundancy isn't waste. Redundancy is the buffer that permits exploration. Redundancy is evolutionary permission to innovate.
Without waste, there is no safe space to try something new.
It's so wild to think about.
When you eliminate the generative margin in a company, you eliminate the future. You lock the system into its present state. You make it highly efficient for today, but terminally brittle for tomorrow.
But let me play the skeptic here for a minute.
Go for it.
Is all this excess and redundancy always a good thing? Because it sounds great in theory, just duplicate everything, keep spare parts lying around, let everyone explore.
Right, it sounds a bit utopian.
Yeah. But if we just keep duplicating genes or keeping spare hospital beds or adding layers to an organization so they can drift and explore, doesn't it just get incredibly messy?
Oh, it gets very messy.
Wouldn't we just end up as giant, chaotic blobs of useless organs and overlapping bureaucracy? Doesn't the complexity eventually drag the system down?
That is exactly the risk, and the author tackles it directly. There is a dark side to complexity. Not all generative drift leads to a glorious new capacity like color vision. Sometimes it leads to what evolutionary biologists call constructive neutral evolution.
Constructive neutral evolution.
Yes. And this is the path to pathological lock-in.
Explain how that works.
So we've just discussed the life coherent dynamic, right?
Mm-hmm.
Reserves leads to exploration, which finds a complementary function, which enlarges capacity.
Right.
But the pathological dynamic works differently. In this scenario, components accumulate and become mutually dependent, not because they are doing something brilliantly new, but simply because other pathways have decayed.
Wait, like a Rube Goldberg machine.
Exactly like a Rube Goldberg machine. A Rube Goldberg machine is incredibly complex balls rolling down ramps, hitting dominoes, triggering springs, flipping levers.
Just to wipe a napkin across a face.
Right. The complexity doesn't add a higher order capacity. It just creates a chain of absolute dependency. If you remove one single piece of the machine, the whole thing fails.
So more complexity does not equal more resilience.
Far from it. System coherence, meaning all the parts fit together and rely on each other, is not the same as life coherence. An arrangement can be internally stable, but functionally useless or even harmful.
Let's look at the biological warning the text uses for this, which is cancer. How exactly does a tumor win locally?
A tumor is a brilliant example of a highly evolvable, incredibly successful local system. Cancer cells essentially exploit variation, redundancy, and selection at the cellular level.
How?
They duplicate their chromosomes recklessly. Most of those mutated cells die. But because they have so much redundant genetic material, one cell randomly stumbles upon a mutation that lets it hide from the immune system or build its own blood supply.
Wow.
It secures its own autopoiesis, but it does so while completely destroying the wider organismal conditions on which it relies.
The tumor survives, but it kills the host.
Exactly.
Now map this onto human society. Think about administrative bureaucracies or overly complex financial systems.
It's the perfect institutional parallel.
A problem occurs in an institution. Right. So a new procedure is added to fix the problem.
Naturally.
But that procedure creates a bottleneck. So another procedure, and maybe a new subcommittee, is added to manage the first procedure.
Yes.
Then the institution creates metrics to prove that everyone is complying with all the procedures. Soon, you have an entire floor of an office building filled with people whose only job is to reproduce the metrics of the procedures.
Dr. Saley calls this institutional autopoietization.
Institutional autopoietization.
It is the progressive displacement of a life-serving purpose by the conservation of the institution's own operations.
The institution forgets that it originally existed to heal patients or educate students or serve citizens.
Its primary goal becomes securing its own revenues, protecting its authority, and managing its reputational security.
It becomes a tumor.
Yes.
It becomes a pathological lock-in. And the worst part is, it actively suppresses feedback.
Oh, complete.
If a frontline nurse tries to say, hey, logging this metric in the software is actually taking time away from the patient, the institution interprets that criticism as a threat to its survival.
It punishes the worker and externalizes the harm onto the citizen.
The institution becomes highly effective at reproducing itself while disabling the host.
This is why internal persistence is not enough. A bureaucracy persisting for 100 years isn't a sign of its value if it's acting as a parasite on the community.
This brings us to a crucial turning point in the whole discussion. We have the biological theory. We see the danger of pathological lock-in.
Right.
So how do we prevent our human systems from becoming tumors? How do we protect the good kind of generative drift and stop the Rube Goldberg machines from taking over?
To answer that, we really have to look deeply at how humans actually coordinate with one another.
Right.
We have to look at what Maturana calls emotioning and languaging.
Let's start with emotioning. Usually when we talk about emotions, especially in a professional or institutional setting, we think of them as private internal feelings that just get in the way of cool, rational logic.
Right. We're told to leave our emotions at the door.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But Maturana argues that reasoning never occurs outside of an emotional domain.
Right. He defines an emotion not as a private feeling, but as a dynamic bodily disposition that specifies a domain of possible action.
That's a mouthful. Break that down.
Okay, so depending on the emotion you are currently embodying, different actions become possible, sensible, or literally unthinkable.
Okay.
Let's take fear. If the dominant emotion in a corporate boardroom is fear, the domain of action opens up to defense, concealment, retreat, and the search for control.
Makes sense.
But if the dominant emotion is curiosity, the domain opens up to exploration and questioning. If it's resentment, the domain opens up to retaliation.
So if an institution, say a hospital or a tech company, is fundamentally governed by a matrix of fear and liability, it doesn't matter how logical their written protocols are.
Not at all.
The logic will be used to serve the fear.
Exactly. Two hospitals might have the exact same written protocols. But if one operates in an emotional domain of blame and defensive documentation, and the other operates in a domain of trust and shared responsibility, they will produce entirely different outcomes.
The rational system justifies the emotional reality.
Spot on. And this ties directly into languaging. Because for Maturana, language isn't just transmitting data bytes from my brain to your brain.
No.
No. Languaging is the recursive, consensual coordination of conduct.
Consensual coordination of conduct.
Right. When we speak, we aren't just describing reality. We are coordinating our actions together to bring forth a shared reality.
Okay, give me an example of that.
Think about the concept of a border or money. These are distinctions that only exist and only have power because we recursively coordinate our actions around them through language.
We literally talk our institutions into existence and then we act them out.
Yes. And because cultures are essentially networks of conversations conserved across generations, civilizations reproduce themselves not just through concrete infrastructure, but through the recurrent emotioning embedded in those conversations.
So if we are coordinating our reality through language, and our language is bounded by our emotioning, what is the specific emotion that allows for generative drift?
Right.
What allows for safe exploration instead of defensive lock-in? Because this is where the paper introduces its most provocative concept,
right?
The biology of love.
And we need to be very careful here because in our culture, the word love is completely saturated with romantic sentimentality or, you know, religious dogma.
Yeah, it sounds a bit woo-woo for a dense academic white paper.
It does. But Dr. Selly is using Maturana's highly technical definition. In this framework, love is the relational dynamic where the other is accepted as a legitimate other in coexistence.
A legitimate other in coexistence. Let's unpack that.
It means you recognize the right of the other person to exist alongside you. It does not mean you agree with everything they do. It does not mean you abolish boundaries. You can firmly oppose an action that causes harm. A society can imprison someone for violence, but you do so without stripping them of their ontological legitimacy.
You do not convert them into disposable matter.
Exactly. You preserve their basic dignity, even in opposition.
And for me, this was the massive aha moment of the entire discussion.
Yeah.
Yeah, because the author draws a direct structural analogy between biology and society. In biological systems, as we discussed with inverse Darwinism, redundancy protects a vital function, while a duplicate part varies and mutates.
Right.
The redundancy provides a safety margin. Well, in human society, love is the redundancy. Love is the relational safety margin.
That is exactly it.
Love protects the person or the idea while they vary or make a mistake or disagree. It ensures that an error in judgment doesn't result in immediate social annihilation.
And consider what happens when a culture lacks this generative margin of love. What happens to a community ruled by status competition? Or a workplace ruled by a punitive hierarchy or, you know, an authoritarian state.
They eliminate their redundancy.
Without relational safety, variation is concealed. If I know that making a mistake or questioning the boss will get me fired or ostracized, I will hide my mistakes.
You'll just flatter the boss.
Exactly. The feedback loop is destroyed. The system becomes blind to its own failures. The collective intelligence of the institution just collapses because everyone is too busy defending themselves to actually coordinate effectively.
This raises an important question, though. Love isn't just about being nice, then. Love is an absolute evolutionary necessity for complex problem solving.
Absolutely. Without it, you get an authoritarian echo chamber that eventually shatters upon contact with reality.
Okay, so we have the theory. We understand autopoiesis. inverse Darwinism, pathological lock-in, and the biology of love. Now, how do we actually put it into practice?
Right. How do we build this into the institutions that affect the listener's daily life?
How do we evaluate if an institution's actually engaging in life-coherent generative drift? The Alta brings in the philosopher John McMurtry and his life value onto axiology.
Yes.
Whoa, onto axiology. That sounds like something you need 3 PhDs to understand. Break that down for someone stuck in traffic right now.
It's actually simpler than it sounds. Ontology is the study of being. Axiology is the study of value. So it's the study of what is truly valuable for a living being to exist.
Okay.
The test is incredibly straightforward. Does a system protect, restore, or enlarge life capacity without transferring disabling costs to other lives or future conditions?
That is the life coherence test.
That's the test.
It cuts right through the noise.
Yes.
It doesn't ask if the system is profitable or if it's technologically advanced or if it has survived a long time. It asks, does it enlarge life?
Let's look at how Dr. Saley applies this to specific real-world domains. Let's dive deep into medicine first.
We touched on this earlier with the COVID hospital example, but the paper advocates for moving from treating static laboratory norms to evaluating a patient's actual physiological reserve.
Right. A patient might have blood test numbers that look perfectly normal because their body is working overtime, exhausting all its regulatory reserve just to maintain those numbers.
Okay.
But the moment they face a minor infection, they crash. A life-coherent medical model looks at the whole capacity to respond to disturbance.
How does that apply to the daily life of a triage nurse or primary care doctor?
It recognizes that lean hospitals with zero margin, where doctors are given exactly 7 minutes per patient, are fundamentally life incoherent.
Right.
The 7-minute window assumes that healing is just an exchange of data. Symptom out, prescription in, it completely destroys the relational safety, the trust, the dialogue, the love necessary for actual healing.
Because when a doctor has time to ask open-ended questions, they are creating a generative margin where hidden symptoms or contextual life issues can actually emerge.
Exactly. Now let's shift to education.
Oh, this is a big one.
In education, a selectionist model organizes everything around ranking, sorting, and artificial scarcity. Standardized testing.
We treat students like widgets on an assembly line being inspected for defects.
Right. But the life-coherent model shifts the organization toward curiosity. It recognizes that play and exploratory time are not a waste of time. They are vital redundancy.
They are the generative margin where students can vary, explore, and discover complementary skills without the constant paralyzing threat of a failing grade.
When a child plays, they are engaging in safe structural drift. They are figuring out how to couple with their environment.
And then there's economics and the civil commons. The paper makes the point that the free market is great at coordinating certain types of production, but it cannot be the only allocator of necessities.
No, it can't. If necessities like healthcare, clean water, and ecological protection are only available through purchasing power, then the market interprets human deprivation simply as market information.
Wait, explain that.
If someone can't afford a life-saving surgery, the selectionist market just says, well, the demand wasn't met with sufficient capital. It views it as an efficiency rather than what it actually is, life harm.
Oh, wow. The author talks about the civil commons, shared public systems, as society's collective generative reserve.
Yes.
Just like a cell needs a buffer to survive a shock, a society needs public institutions to ensure that its citizens can take risks, fail, get sick, and learn, without facing total destitution.
If you want a society of entrepreneurs and innovators, you actually need a massive safety net so they can afford to take risks without starving.
Let's talk about artificial intelligence because the paper addresses it beautifully and it's on everyone's mind.
AI is described as a massive abductive variation engine.
Explain how an AI uses abduction. Because it doesn't actually know facts, right?
Exactly. Large language models don't store a database of true facts. They analyze massive amounts of human language and generate plausible resemblances built on patterns.
They make leaps based on likeness.
Right. They generate icons of meaning. It can generate hypotheses, images, and code at lightning speed. It's an engine of variation. But its value depends entirely on structural coupling.
Meaning how it is integrated into our world.
Yes. Consider two scenarios. In one, an AI is coupled with a medical team. It generates dozens of differential diagnoses rapidly, acting as a massive generative reserve of ideas.
Okay.
But the doctors use their contextual judgment, their life coherence, to treat the patient. The AI enlarges human agency.
And the second scenario?
The AI is deployed by a selectionist healthcare monopoly to replace the doctors entirely. Patients are forced into rigid algorithmic pathways to cut costs.
Yikes.
The AI becomes a tool of pathological lock-in, intensifying surveillance, and displacing human cognition. The technology itself isn't inherently life-coherent or incoherent. The way it couples with our institutions is.
I want to interject here to make something very clear to the listener, because it might be easy to hear terms like biology of love or civil commons and think this is just dressing up a specific political ideology in biological jargon.
And this is a crucial distinction. The paper points out that this isn't about romanticizing forced cooperation or picking a political side.
Right.
The text explicitly says this is not a romantic denial of conflict, competition, or even death. Predators exist. Selection happens.
So what is it really about?
What this is really about is ensuring that institutions are corrigible.
Corrigibility, the capacity to be corrected.
Yes.
Whether an institution is a private corporation, a state-run hospital, or a local co-op, the biological question remains the exact same. Can it receive evidence of harm? And can it actually change its core operations in response?
Or does it just produce another PR report while continuing to act like a pathological tumor? A massive state-run bureaucracy can be just as blindly autopoietic and tumor-like as a ruthless corporate monopoly. It's all about establishing feedback loops. The author outlines a life-coherent institutional protocol to help us diagnose our systems.
What kind of questions does it ask?
It asks things like, what living purpose is conserved? What generative margin, what reserve of time, staff, and trust is required? Which voices and variations are currently being suppressed by fear? And most importantly, who bears the cross-scale life effects?
Local efficiency achieved by dumping toxic waste into a river is life incoherent.
Exactly. It gives us a totally new vocabulary to evaluate our world.
And that basically brings us to the end of our journey today. So let's recap where we've been. We started with this brittle, scarcity-driven myth that everything must be optimized and the weak must be eliminated.
And we dismantled it using autopoiesis and natural drift, showing that life is really about conserving organization while structurally wandering without a predetermined map.
We saw how inverse Darwinism proves that excess, duplication, and redundancy, what we mistakenly call waste, are actually the evolutionary prerequisites for innovation. You literally need a spare part to invent something new.
We explored the danger of constructive neutral evolution, where complexity just creates fragile pathological lock-in like a bureaucracy protecting its own metrics at the expense of its actual purpose.
And finally, we brought it into the human realm with Maturana's emotioning and the biology of love. We learned that treating others as legitimate participants in coexistence provides the relational safety margin necessary for collective intelligence and problem solving.
And we evaluate all of this through life coherence.
Yeah.
Does the system enlarge the capacities of life without transferring disabling costs to others?
It is a profound shift in perspective.
It really is.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener? How do you take this dense biological philosophy into your daily life?
Right.
Next time you're sitting in a meeting and you see inefficiency in your workplace, maybe people are taking too long to brainstorm, or ideas are overlapping, or the creative process feels a bit messy, remember that you might not be looking at waste.
You might be looking at the exact generative reserve needed for your next breakthrough.
You do not have to optimize every second of your life.
Mm.
The space where you aren't producing is the space where you are becoming capable of something new.
Building on the source's conclusion, I'll leave you with this final thought. Evolution doesn't give us a moral instruction to dominate one another. It doesn't tell us that the ruthless win.
Right.
What it tells us is that continuity and change are fundamentally inseparable. So as you look at your own community, your workplace, or our society at large, ask yourself the author's final provocative question.
Which is?
What must we conserve together if life is to remain capable of becoming otherwise?
Wow. What a question to leave on. Thank you so much for joining us as the third person in this conversation today. Mm-hmm. We love going on this deep dive into the source material with you. Stay curious, keep exploring, and remember to leave a little generative margin in your day.